Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I am Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros.
And we have a well-known video game attorney who has actually gone by the name
Video Game Attorney.
Mr. Ryan Marson. He will be joining us later. Ryan is the co-founder of Marson Rothman, a law firm that specializes in the game industry. He's also the CEO of Evolve Talent, which is a talent agency that reps a number of esports athletes. But before we get to our conversation with Ryan, we've got some news.
We actually have quite a bit of news to cover today. We've got one big news beat, and we've got a couple of smaller ones that we're going to touch on briefly. So why don't you lead us into what is going on with Nintendo's latest investor.
Nintendo has found itself with a significant investor to the tune of $1.1 billion. The group is called Value Act. They're a capital investment firm, and this was brought to our attention because Dan Ahmad had tweeted about this off of a Reuters story. And what's really interesting about Value Act is they are an activist investor.
What is an activist investor? It sounds like, you know, you're going out and you are being an activist for a specific cause, but I don't think that that's what an actual activist investor is. I know that's what you immediately think of. So let's jump into term sheet.
Term sheet!
Yay!
Yay! So if you have not listened to the show before, we have a recurring segment called Term Sheet, and it is time for term sheet. In this segment, we take a piece of industry jargon, we put it in a blender, and make a smooth paste of easily digestible information. Yum.
Ew. That continues to be so gross. A smooth paste. Michael, are you eating paste again?
Soylent Green is made of brain meats.
Well, we learned something today, and that's the end of, no, it's not the end of term sheet. So we're talking about activist and what an activist investor is. So yes. Please define what an
so
activist
I tried
is.
To find a good definition that was already out there. I found one from IMD Business School, and they define an activist investor as a shareholder at a publicly traded company who attempts to affect change in an organization either by directly appealing to or putting heavy pressure on the company's board of directors, bypassing the normal advisory process. Now, just a quick reminder about governance. Because this popped up when we were talking about Reggie joining Nintendo or joining GameStop's board of directors. Now,
Reggie will always be Nintendo.
Right, Reggie will always be like
Nintendo of America.
My body is ready to link Reggie to Nintendo. So the important thing to note is like you have directors at a staff level and you have directors on your board of directors. And it's important to know what the difference is when we're talking about a board of directors, which is the governance of an organization. For nonprofits, it's called a board of trustees. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about a director, they're usually compensated in a for-profit company. They're not in a nonprofit company. They're compensated at a nominal rate for their expertise, and they do bring a level of understanding and expertise of a facet of the organization's business. So when Reggie came on the board of GameStop, obviously coming from a first party perspective, there were also people who were brought on who were experts in retail, who had
logistics.
So the things that were challenging GameStop. So it's important to understand that when we're talking about an investor, and again, this is someone who has $1.1 billion invested in Nintendo, Value Act I'm talking about.
Yes.
You know, they have a significant amount of control, you would think, except Nintendo's an enormous company. So their $1.1 billion in shares only amounts to
2%.
2%. So this is not a hostile takeover. There's nothing to be worried about. This is a
group. This isn't a Vivendi?
This is not a Vivendi situation. I'm so glad that you mentioned that. We're not going to dive into the history of Vivendi and Ubisoft and Vivendi and Activision and all of that. That's a trip down memory lane for another time.
If Vivendi ever rears its ugly head again.
Which it probably will. However, so in this case, you've got a significant investor that's amassed $1.1 billion in shares. They have 2% control. They do not have a seat on the board at this time, and they likely will not be seeking one because, as Dan Ahmad went into on Twitter, Value Act does not typically exert its control publicly. This is not going to be a lot of bluster. They are a capital investment firm that has a specific set of expertise And we'll talk about that in a second.
Yes.
But they typically work quietly. And this is not a one-to-one, but when we talk about Tencent making an investment in a company, chances are, like, a lot of the times, and I wrote a big piece about Tencent for Polygon, when they helped Ubisoft get out from under Vivendi.
Yes.
Ooh, wow, coming full circle.
We sure did.
Tencent is usually pretty quiet.
Yes.
Facebook is another one. When they make an acquisition, they're usually pretty quiet. They haven't...
Unless they outright absorb the company, fold the company, and then reopen it later on as something completely different.
Yes. But in the past, when we're talking about Instagram, for instance, being a good example.
Sure. Instagram is a good example. Oculus is a good example. Mm-hmm. You know, except that Oculus, they exerted enormous control.
Yes. And brought them inside. So in this case, though, what we expect is, and the reason that ValueAct has expressed so much interest in Nintendo, is they see Nintendo as having the potential to go toe-to-toe with other digital companies. They mentioned Apple Music. They mentioned Tencent. Interactive Entertainment. They mention Netflix, and interestingly, they mention Disney Plus, and this is the one that jumped out to me. If you think about Disney, mm-hmm. owning Marvel, owning Star Wars, those huge brands, and you think about all the ways that Disney has used those brands.
Transmedia, specifically.
Exactly. So you've got comic books.
Yeah.
You've got movies and TV.
You've got their attractions at the various amusement parks that Disney owns.
Mm-hmm. You've got video games.
Yeah.
And
you have board games.
You have board games. So you have this very holistic transmedia approach coming from...
And toys.
Now, we're starting to see some of that from Nintendo anyway.
Yes. There's the Nintendo Lego partnership.
Yep, which is
great.
That
was relatively... recent.
And that's a very Nintendo approach to Lego, because it's gamified Lego.
It's gamified, right? Lego, yeah.
As opposed to a Lego-fied video game, which...
Okay, that might break my brain a little.
Aha!
Aha! We did it!
Nintendo is also doing the theme park thing in partnership with Universal.
Super Nintendo World. So, I mean, these are really interesting things that Nintendo is bringing into the world. But they have one glaring piece of their business that they have underutilized for many years.
Yeah, and that's, they haven't taken their brands. I mean, obviously we've had the Super Mario Brothers movie in the 80s, which is an artifact of its time.
It's so bad.
Yeah.
It's so bad. It loops around to good and then flips off the audience and then goes right back around to bad.
Yeah.
I mean, in a nutshell.
And there was the TV show. There's the Super Mario Brothers Super Hour.
I don't even remember that. I don't think I watched that.
Captain Lou Albano played Mario. And so on Monday through Thursday, you had like the Super Mario cartoon. And then on Fridays, it was Legend of Zelda. Excuse me, princess.
Wow.
Yeah. And then there was Captain N.
Yes.
Captain N the Game Master.
Yes, I do remember that.
Vaguely. With like the worst caricature of Simon Belmont, I think, could have ever been imagined.
That's very true. I think I watched that years and years after that was canceled.
Yeah.
So that is a big piece of where Nintendo has classically fallen down with their brand, is they have never been able to bridge the gap into non-interactive digital media.
And I would say that the closest they've come is Pokemon, but again, they have a stake in the Pokemon company, but that's still the Pokemon company.
It's not Nintendo. It's not like you're seeing Mario showing up in a Pokemon, like in an episode of Pokemon the anime.
Yeah, we did have, I mean, there were some Nintendo characters that showed up in Wreck-It Ralph, but again,
that's different.
It is different.
That's licensing.
Exactly.
And that's a Disney licensing thing. So, I mean, the fact that Nintendo does allow some licensing, because Bowser was in there.
Mm-hmm.
Who else was in Wreck-It Ralph?
Boy, I don't even remember.
I don't remember. I think it might have only been Bowser. Maybe that's all I could afford.
I don't think I remember Ganon being in there.
Maybe, though.
I don't think so.
I don't know. There's a lot of video game characters.
There was, yeah.
A lot of video game characters in Wreck-It Ralph. But that again, that's different. That's licensing. That's a third party versus a first party.
Right.
So what's the significance? If ValueAct is investing in Nintendo as an activist investor, they clearly want to exert some kind of influence in how Nintendo is shaping a specific piece of their business.
Mm-hmm.
So where is their areas of expertise?
They are with the shift to digital. And with taking those models, that Netflix model, that Disney Plus model, and saying, hey, you've got these great brands, you're not doing as much with them as you can, Value Act can bring to the table some expertise in helping Nintendo.
Maybe some vendor partnerships.
Exactly. So some opportunity here to improve that shift to digital. We know Nintendo has struggled with the shift to digital. I mean, friend codes, it's certainly gotten better with the Switch. But if I look at Animal Crossing, and we look at that online experience for Animal Crossing,
first you've got to
trade Switch codes with your friend, and then you have to go to their island. You can't even like become best friends until you go to the island. And then there's the multi-step process at the Dodo counter to be able to actually go somewhere or open your gates. It's just, it's very cumbersome. And I'm sure that's not just what Value Act is looking at, but I think that is emblematic of Nintendo's struggle with this shift to digital. Now, they've done some other things really well.
It's not just the shift to digital, though. I think it's a shift to social.
That's a good one, too. Now, the fact that you can...
Let's look at how Splatoon 2 ended up handling online multiplayer.
Oof, yeah, with the app on the phone being the only way to do voice chat. And yeah, there are some places. What I expect to see, and again, it's going to be quiet. We'll never necessarily see a direct... one-to-one, like, oh, Value Act said this and now Nintendo's doing this. Because exactly. They're not going to talk publicly.
No, they're going to be really quiet behind the scenes. They're going to do what they do and help steer the ship in small, meaningful ways.
And they don't want to be the star, if I had to guess. They want Nintendo to look like geniuses. And the good news is, again, remember, this is not a corporate takeover. This is not a hostile takeover. We're talking
2%. This isn't a merger. This is very, very small.
It is. Even though the raw... dollar figure is a lot.
It's a lot of money, Mike.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. So what we know and what we can expect here is that we're going to see Nintendo probably being smarter and more holistic in its approach to digital. I wouldn't be surprised.
I hope social as well.
I hope so too. I would not be surprised if in the coming years we start to see more non-interactive adaptations, as you point out, of some key brands. Metroid's ripe for that, especially with Metroid 4, we know, somewhere in the distance. Metroid's a great opportunity to do something very cool with a Nintendo brand. The Legend of Zelda, given how many different takes there have been, even in video game form, it's not really a continuous story. And Breath of the Wild, if I recall correctly, doesn't even exist on the timeline. They're not talking about where it is on the timeline.
No, because it exists in its own pocket universe.
Yeah. You've got this opportunity here to say, well, we're going to tell a Legend of Zelda story. And it could be...
We're going to be telling a Legend of Zelda story that is geared towards children. Mm-hmm. We are going to be telling a Legend of Zelda story that's reminiscent of Netflix's Castlevania.
Sure. And I think there's really a cool opportunity here. I want to look at Marvel specifically, because if you look at the way Marvel has handled its non-interactive stuff, you've got the same characters. You've got Deadpool, who is not a kid's superhero.
No,
or he's anti-hero.
He's intense.
Yeah, and you've got him showing up in Ultimate Spider-Man. Right? And they can sanitize Deadpool for a kid's audience.
Absolutely. They don't have to make him as intense or sweary.
And the same thing on the video game side, and I talked to Mel Kirk about this from Zen Studios when I was writing the Game Dev Business Handbook, about licensing and how there's an opportunity there to take some very cool adult-focused things and make them okay for kids so that you have an installed audience for when those kids age up. And there's two things that I can think of where again, I'm going to use Deadpool because he is the perfect, like, this is not for kids character.
Extremely not for kids.
And that is the Marvel Pinball. Yes. Is when there was a Deadpool table.
Yeah.
And then Lego. Deadpool shows up all over Lego Marvel Super Heroes.
He is also in Fortnite.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And John Wick, again, was another Fortnite
crossover. Oh, and then the rest of X-Force popped up in Fortnite, too. So you got Domino and Cable and
that's so cool.
X-Force Psylocke. Rules. Yep.
X-Force rules.
X-Force, give it to you.
Wow. And that's the end of that.
Yep. So, I mean, we just wanted to touch on this because, A, it was a good opportunity to do a term sheet on activist investors because the concept... can have a very negative connotation, but Nintendo's stock price went up.
It did.
As a result of this. And so
boosted investor confidence.
Yep. Yep. Kudos to Reuters on that story. They had the exclusive. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see where that goes. We won't, again, have a one-to-one correlation between Value Act and Nintendo.
Yeah, exactly. Likely what we'll see are small, meaningful steps in a direction that embraces transmedia in a more meaningful way.
Yep. And with that, we have a couple of other smaller news hits that we wanted to touch on before we jump into the interview.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing that we want to talk about is Epic finally bringing Fortnite to Google Play. That is an enormous change. Mm-hmm. And it was an enormous change that was mostly forced.
Sure. Actually, do you want to set the stage here? So sure. why is this such a big deal that that Fortnite is now on Google Play?
So for, my goodness, I think it's been for the last 2 years specifically, Fortnite, it might be less time than that, but I think it's 2 years. So Fortnite has been famously not interested in walled garden ecosystems. They are on iOS because on Apple's devices, there is no way to just install a game. It has to be installed via the Google Play Store. Otherwise, you have to use something like Test Flight.
Mm-hmm.
And Test Flight doesn't support microtransactions, I don't believe, because it's just for testing, right? Yeah. We've both used Test Flight. So Tim Sweeney, who's the CEO of Epic Games, is rigidly and staunchly against any closed ecosystems, including Google. Mm-hmm. Like the Google Play Store.
And he's spoken out against Windows.
He's spoken out against Oculus, mm-hmm, as a walled garden.
Absolutely. So he was very much in the crossplay camp.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Tim was a big reason why crossplay ended up becoming such a big issue for a company like Sony.
Mm-hmm.
Sony was the holdout,
it
right?
Was.
I mean, Fortnite came out on Switch, and it could play, the Fortnite players on Switch could play with players on Xbox, and they could play with players on PC, on mobile, basically anywhere except PlayStation 4.
Yeah. I mean, Sony got hit on that over and over and over again for months. I mean, it was Rocket League.
It was 3 months, I think.
And Minecraft was a huge one because, you know, signing into Xbox Live on your Switch is still kind of a weird, surreal experience.
It is very surreal. I don't know how I feel about that other than delighted, I suppose.
Another piece of the whole Epic not being, or Fortnite not being on Google Play was that this was around the time where we started talking about the Epic Game Store.
Yes.
And where Tim Sweeney really stepped up to the plate, and Epic really stepped up to the plate and said 30% for what? Why does Google get 30% of any in-game transactions?
Mm-hmm. When they're not the ones that are putting in the hard work, the marketing dollars. They are literally just the platform holder. That's
absolutely
it.
And now there are other costs to maintaining a platform.
Of course.
So we're not blind to those, but this was Epic has been pushing against that 30% for a long time, and then put its money where its mouth was when the Epic Game Store came out and mm-hmm. set their rate at 88-12, so 88% to developers and 12% to the platform. So they released a statement.
To the storefront.
To the store,
in this particular case.
Yes.
Because remember that, you know, Apple iOS is a platform, Windows is a platform, but on the Windows platform, there are storefronts.
Steam and GOG and Epic, and those are storefronts.
Those are considered storefronts.
Yes.
Steam is about as close as you get to a separate platform, but it's still a storefront with some really cool features.
Indeed. So, Epic finally says, all right, look, we need to put it on Android. And here was the statement they put out explaining. And I quote, Google puts software downloadable outside of Google Play at a disadvantage through technical and business measures, such as scary repetitive security pop-ups for downloaded and updated software, restrictive manufacturer and carrier agreements and dealings, Google public relations characterizing third-party software sources as malware, oof, and new efforts such as Google Play Protect to outright block software obtained outside the Google Play Store. I think that last one is probably...
That's the good old nail in the coffin.
Yep. Because of this, we've launched Fortnite for Android on the Google Play Store. We hope that Google will revise its policies and business dealings in the near future so that all developers are free to reach and engage in commerce with customers on Android and in the Play Store through open services, including payment services, that can compete on a level playing field. So I'm hoping you actually designed for Android.
I did.
And can you talk a little bit about specifically the allegation here that Google goes out of its way to throw up scary, repetitive security pop-ups for downloaded and updated software?
Yes, I can. So back in the day, man, they were days of yore at this point. It was like 5 years ago. I was a designer, so I was a UI designer, and I worked with a financial technology company for a couple of years on some software with them and on their app that was also released over on the Google Play Store. But while we were testing, we had to install these separate APKs. So on my old, I think it was a Samsung Galaxy something or other.
You had an S6, I think.
No.
S7?
I think it was a 4.
Oh, okay. My mistake.
It was many years ago. I'm pretty sure it was a 4. Because it was back in like 2014 that I picked it up. Okay. Because I was really tired of my Apple phone being the worst. And then my Galaxy phone was even worser. And yes, I said worser on purpose. So yeah, installing these APKs, I mean, it's not really a big deal. It seems kind of scary and kind of shady to be installing things on the sly and underneath, you know, Google Play, but they do put up those harsh pop-ups, and it's definitely a, do you trust this? It's the same kind of thing on Windows, for that matter. You know, it has to be a trusted source in order for Windows to be like, all right, so check it out. If you install this, this is probably going to hurt you. It's the same kind of thing on Android. It's, are you sure that you want to run this? We don't know this. We don't know this person. We don't know this application. We haven't vetted this. Well, without taking into account the fact that malware, especially on Android, gets snuck into APKs that make it onto the Google Play Store. Mm-hmm. Because the Google Play Store and Android in general is supposed to be an open platform. It's not like any Mac mm-hmm. or Apple products, right? Like Apple is very closed in. It's very bespoke. It's you gotta belong to the crowd. You gotta be one of the cool kids in order to get one of your apps onto the App Store.
There are a lot of cool kids these days, though.
Are there, though?
Well,
it's not us.
No.
No, well, we're not the cool kids. so yeah, it's, I think the reason why, though, this was such a blow is because Android is supposed to be open. It's supposed to be friendlier for developers to just go on and make things and kind of make a mess and take things apart and put things back together. Like, that's very much so the way that Android was supposed to be designed. And seeing something like Google Play Protect, which I'm sure has you know, non-nefarious things going on, kind of comes across as being another way to wall in an ecosystem that's supposed to be open in the first place.
And to their credit, clearly it's working if it's pushing Epic to make the move here.
I'm sure that what ended up happening here, like if I had to speculate, I'm sure that what ended up happening is Epic was looking at their Fortnite numbers just plummeting on Android because mm-hmm. parents are probably looking at something like on their kids' Kindle Fire or on one of these other tablets. And they're really locked down. Like, these manufacturers do lock these tablets down right down to where you cannot install these APKs. Or once you do install them, you can't run them. You can't get to them because their version of the Android operating system, which has been modified, won't allow you to.
Sure. And I popped over to their website. One of the images that they use here, they scan your apps, right? And it tells you if you've got any apps that are kind of problematic. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at one here where with Play Protect, it actually says harmful app removed, where it's automatically removed an app. And it's called Puzzle Game Pro. So there's a game app that they're even mentioning. This app can damage your device, add hidden charges to your mobile bill, or steal your personal information. So there's that scare tactic. So it is entirely possible that you've got this APK installed legitimately on your phone. It's Fortnite mm-hmm. from Epic's Android store. Mm-hmm. And that Play Protect could go ahead and remove it from your phone.
It just, it introduces a lot of messy nonsense. And, you know, Sweeney's always been about, let's open up the ecosystems, not close it down further. But at the end of the day, they have to reach their audience. their audience is on Android, mm-hmm. and they can't just ignore their, they can't just ignore a segment of their user base.
And, you know,
no matter how inconvenient it is.
Of course. And I think that the one thing that people kind of raised an eyebrow about is the wording of Epic's statement. And I guess the only thing I have to say about that is that it is consistent with the way Epic and Tim Sweeney have approached this issue in the past.
Mm-hmm.
If this were out of nowhere, like, wow, you're throwing a partner under the bus, I would completely understand. But this is not the first time where Sweeney and Epic have, yeah, no.
This is like the dozenth, maybe?
Yeah, this is the company's position. This is its leader's position on opening up marketplaces and keeping ecosystems open.
The only thing about this that I have been thinking a lot about over the last couple of days since, you know, we first talked about this is the Epic Game Store itself is a closed ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
Not just any game can go on to EGS. So that, for me, that's the challenging part, because that seems like that's moving in a hypocritical way.
Yeah, I and that is certainly something we'll have to continue to explore, because we know that Epic, you know, its intention was to start small and then open up, and we'll see.
We'll have to see what they end up doing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm confident in the fact that, you know, Sweeney does often walk the talk, but we just haven't seen it yet. And I'm hoping that they will walk the talk in a broader capacity over the next several years, the next handful of years, really, once they have EGS in a place where they will be able to handle the deluge of amazing indie games that I'm sure will be coming through their doors.
Absolutely. All right, we got one more quick hit, and then a listener question, then on to our interview. So the other quick hit, you have covered Fig, the yes. crowdfunding and crowd investing platform. I have covered Fig, the crowdfunding and crowd investing platform. We've both done interviews with CEO Justin Bailey. Big news this week. There was and I think the best write-up we saw was the Games Industry article about this.
Yeah,
link is in the show notes.
Serious shout-out to James Batchelor on this piece. Excellent context.
Absolutely. So, Fig has been acquired by Republic. But what is Republic?
All right, so Republic is another crowd investing platform that grew out of another site called AngelList, which was a website for job seekers, angel investors, and startups. So Republic does some similar crowd investment kinds of campaigns. And according to, was this according to their website?
No, I believe this was also right out of the Games Industry.
Okay, awesome. So what James Batchelor ended up writing about in his Games Industry article is that the average Republic investment campaign in 2019 was $500,000, with more than $100 million raised since the platform started in 2016. So crowd investing is really it's interesting. It's not for everybody. It's not for every project.
No, it's not.
But it's effective for very specific kinds of projects and very specific kinds of communities.
Mm-hmm. So we have seen a number of really cool projects come out of Fig. Outer Wilds
that one
returned well for investors. It got picked up. Annapurna, I believe, purchased the rights to that.
That's right.
And then published it. So that paid out really well. There was the Jay and Silent Bob game that got funded.
Mm-hmm.
Phoenix Point was funded through Fig.
Psychonauts 2
was funded through Fig.
They also received their investment back once Microsoft purchased Double Fine Entertainment.
So there have been a number, and
Soundfall is a big one.
Soundfall
is a big one. I've spoken with both of the founders at that studio. I can't remember what the studio's name is, but Soundfall is this brilliant little rhythm game that I'm so excited for it to come out. And I've just kind of been bouncing on my heels waiting for this game for like a year. That's a really, really cool game. And they are truly indie. Like, they are definitely indie, but these are two gentlemen where they are very business focused. Mm-hmm. That's why they were able to get on board with Fig, and with, you know, Justin was like, no, listen, you guys are going to be great for this. And I mean, they weren't wrong.
Absolutely. And then I know that both of us are particularly fond of Chorus, which was funded through Fig.
Yes.
So Fig is established.
But we're like a little biased.
A little biased.
tiny biased.
Tiny biased. Friends there. So Fig has been really successful. They've been experimenting. They had kind of done like a rolling, like early access style thing. I got the idea of when I, or the feeling from Justin when I spoke to him last, that maybe that didn't, that was going to be retuned just a little bit.
That's what Fig does though. Mm-hmm. Fig goes out, speaks with their partners that are going to be launching their investment campaigns, their crowd investment campaigns. They work with them on specific features that the partners believe would be most helpful to them. And then that gets fed back into Fig, like generally. Mm-hmm. So they're constantly learning, they're constantly expanding, and they are constantly iterating, which is so important, especially now where it's still the de facto standard that Kickstarter does the thing. But video games on Kickstarter aren't usually successful.
Yep. That's
another conversation entirely. That trend has changed,
and yes, we'll kick that conversation down the road. But the interesting thing here is that Republic obviously has been very successful.
Yes.
They had been talking to their investors, figuring out where to take their platform next, and there was a big gap. Investors on their platform wanted video games.
Yeah.
So instead of reinvent the wheel, they acquired Fig, which sounds awesome. It sounds like a really smart fit. It's
mutually beneficial.
Yes. And it also means that Fig is going to be able to do some things that it wasn't able to do before.
So what this is going to be able to give Fig access to is a wider pool of people and a wider audience to be able to say like, hey, we know you like doing this crowd investing thing. How about you come and invest with Fig? And then that can snowball itself into, okay, well, we can work with more partners. We can still be choosy, mm-hmm. but we can continue to expand and grow and change. What this means, the biggest change though, is that there will be new categories. So this is interesting. Mm-hmm. Like this is really interesting because they're going to be introducing their first hardware campaign for the Intellivision Amico.
Yes.
That's different.
It is. And I still don't know what to make of the Intellivision Amico. I know Tommy Tallarico, who is spearheading the project, and he acquired the Intellivision brand. And
yeah.
I don't know what to make of it yet.
I mean, we obviously haven't touched it. We haven't really, you know, done too. It's not up for anybody to preview just yet. So,
mm-hmm. But the campaign that will be running on Fig, mm-hmm. which has no plan to change its operations very suddenly. There's going to be a very gradual transition.
As it should be.
Yeah, absolutely. This is going to happen in October. It's going to be a pre-order and investment campaign. So it's going to happen very close to what we assume will be the Intellivision Amico's launch.
Mm-hmm.
And that wraps up news. We have a listener question.
We do have a listener question. This listener question comes from Matthew Glenn. So Matthew writes to us, hey, Mike and Amanda, I got a quick question for the podcast. It is about ReadPop.
It's about PAX West in particular.
Specifically, it is about PAX West. Matthew tells us, asking media, developers, and the general public to buy tickets and make plans for PAX West at this point seems careless at best and negligent at worst. This seems like something doomed to be canceled. Could there be some weird pandemic insurance reason they have to schedule an event so that the governor can cancel it with an extended social distance order? Well,
yes.
Yeah, that's exactly. You
pretty much answered your question.
You did.
But given that you were certainly not the only person having this conversation or that we've seen asking, what is ReadPop thinking?
I had this conversation on Ready Player Mom yesterday, of all places.
So, in order for our understanding is that if they were just to cancel it on their own without knowing if Washington is going to be reopened and able to host events, we assume, by the way, that
not
it is
so much.
Not. But you have to look at what the government orders are. If the government says, hey, we are canceling all events through middle of September. Now, remember, PAX West is a little later this year because of Labor Day. So it's mm-hmm. like, I think it's the 4th through the 7th.
Is it really?
So even if they cancel through August, that puts ReadPop in a very bad position.
It does.
Because if everything reopens on September 1st, you're going to have people reluctant to travel. You're going to have bookings down. You're going to have exhibitors that aren't able to or interested in showing. It's going to be really challenging.
And any responsible business owner that is looking at events right now is not putting, they're not putting any resources, whether that's time or money or human, towards event planning whatsoever right now, unless it's digital.
Yeah.
That would be irresponsible. It'd be irresponsible for publishers, exhibitors, whatever, and vendors to sit down and be like, okay, yeah, we're definitely counting on PAX West. We're not talking about PAX Unplugged, which usually happens in December in Philadelphia, but we're talking specifically about a September, an early September conference on the tail end of a pandemic.
And I think
that, and it would be irresponsible.
It would be
right?
irresponsible. And I think that the way that the state, that state governments are going to be able to help, and this will help exhibitors in order to claim insurance funds, because all these events have insurance connected to
them. Oh, they have to.
Absolutely. So what I think is likely to happen is that we will see stay-at-home orders lifted long before, by an order of months, before large public gathering orders are lifted.
Agreed.
So you will get, what will happen is you'll start to see people get used to traveling again, staying in hotels again, interacting with people one-on-one again. So you'll start
but
to see business
still with masks.
But still with masks. I mean, you're going to see business travel start to ease a little bit first. You're going to see personal travel to see family start to ease. But I think we're going to see large gatherings. And remember, PAX West is tens of thousands of people.
Yeah.
It's the entire down, like that block of downtown.
It's the last time I looked, it was between 60 and 70,000 people over the course of 4 days.
And tons of hotels and eateries and, you know,
it gets packed in the Washington Convention Center.
Absolutely. So I think what's likely to happen is that even if we're back at work in offices, for those people who do work in offices in Seattle and Washington, I don't think we're going to see large gathering bans lifted
until we have a vaccine.
Yeah. I mean, I think that ultimately Reed Pop is going to be, you know, able to lean on the government saying, no, we're not allowed to hold this event. But at the same time,
their hands are tied. Like they have to adhere to what their insurance is going to be able to pay them back for their deposits, for all of the things that they've already, for all the money they've already put into the event. Like, I mean, the planning, logistics, and all that stuff, I mean, that's sunk cost. Like, yeah. You can't get that back. But anything to do with booking the facility or putting deposits down and everything like that, like, I'm assuming that much like GDC, that insurance would cover it. And they can't do anything until they have an order from the government that says, hey, check it out, no large gatherings through, you know, X amount of time.
Right. And these facilities are booked years in advance. So it's not like they went out and they booked a facility just assuming they were going to be able to get back into the space in early September. I think the other question on this, and this is where I'm a little confused. We don't usually hear about PAX West at this time of year. They actually came right out and said that in the statement. So putting out the statement they did right now is kind of a big question mark for me. I don't quite understand what it was they were trying to accomplish.
So if, from my perspective, if it were me looking at the conversations around conferences through the year, so we have no Gamescom, which is directly before PAX, mm-hmm. and they don't start talking about Gamescom for another month.
Yeah.
That's another thing.
I mean,
to
we
consider.
Know Gamescom is not happening in a physical
way. Yeah. Because if we think that PAX is big, we've already talked about this. Gamescom is hundreds of thousands of people as opposed to tens of thousands of people. That's a lot. It's those from every picture I've ever seen of Gamescom, it is bananas.
I have been at the top of those escalators.
I'm going to take a hard pass on that there, good friend. No, thank you. So if it were me and I were taking a look at the state of conversations around conferences and conventions for the rest of the year as like the last bastion of gaming conventions, they are the only ones, Reed Pop, they are the only ones that haven't made a statement about what is going on with their event. Mm-hmm. And I think that they wanted to get out ahead of the story instead of it being speculation for months and months and months on end. They want people to, I mean, like, it's not the statement. I would have put out a different statement.
Yes, I think that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I would have put out a different statement that's just like, look, we're evaluating. We're trying to figure this out. You know, we're just as anxious to have PAX as you are, but we also want to adhere to governance for the state of Washington. For now, we are remaining, we're remaining hopeful that we're going to be able to hold PAX West, but we're going to update you along the way. We just wanted to let you know, don't panic yet. We're going to give you more information as we get it. Mm-hmm. But because the statement was worded the way it was like, okay, but this is just seeming like hubris. This doesn't seem like hope. This is hubris.
Yeah. And the takeaway here is they're in a tough position.
Oh, they're in a literal no-win position right now.
I just probably wouldn't have gone with that statement.
No, I would have changed the wording on that quite a bit to hedge more, I suppose. So with that, we're able to say hello to our guest for the day. So let's go get Ryan.
Today on the show, we have a good friend, a brilliant person. And he's not laughing at me yet, so that's good. Now he is.
I wasn't sure if this is the kind of introduction where I'm allowed to speak before introduced, but how dare you?
How dare!
We have with us Mr. Ryan Morrison, who is the founding partner of, or a co-founding partner of Morrison Rothman. He's also the CEO of Evolved Talent and the vice president of the esports bar. Ryan, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for saying yes. We are.
We like it when smart people. What did we pay you with? Pizza?
I compliments.
Just love.
Oh. Compliments. Oh, well, you can have that in abundance.
So Ryan and I have known each other for a number of years.
Yeah, I was actually just talking to my partner Allison about this. It's been since, I mean, you were one of the first people I met in the industry, I think.
Yeah, I mean, so like 2013, 2014, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has been a while.
What a ride. Nothing's changed. It's the same industry.
Exactly the same.
100% the same.
So thank you all for listening to the show. This is our last episode. Nothing has changed, nor will it ever.
Wait, that goes against literally everything we've been talking about. No, it's breaking my brain. I don't like it.
Just roll with it. It's all good.
So, wrinkling my brain.
Ryan, I am sure that many of our listeners know who you are, but for those who are just meeting you for the first time, can you tell us a little bit about your history and why you chose to practice law that intersects with the video game industry?
Yeah, for sure. So I went to law school wanting to be a criminal defense attorney, and through a million different very strange circumstances, one of which being my first internship was with Anthony Weiner, the congressman who showed his wiener. He did that on my first day of the internship and kind of...
Hold on. Wait,
are you
what?
Talking about the very public incident, or did he do this to you?
Well, I was the photographer. But quite literally, my first day of the job was when he tweeted out that picture. So my job became go in that room and shred everything before I get kicked out of here. And then it turned into me having to emergency pivot and find other internships and work. And I found an opportunity at Large Animal Games in New York City, which was a game developer, and learned a lot about the back end of the industry, working in kind of business and legal there. Doing everything from marketing to filing trademarks. And I also started taking more intellectual property courses at school. I was very, very lucky that my law school had a video game class. We were one of maybe three schools in the country that did. And it showed me that, you know, this is a thing, but it's not really a thing yet. So what I did was I looked into the industry a lot, and I realized that the only video game companies that had attorneys were the AAA studios, the EA, Sony, et cetera, that could afford them. And there was a ton of AA studios, a ton of indies that just A, couldn't afford an attorney, and B, had no, you know, idea when they should even speak to one. So I went on Reddit and I started just basically saying, hey, once a week I'll go on here and I'll answer your legal questions. It turned into a lot of people calling me video game attorney. I ran with the marketing.
Solid.
Yeah. And then, you know, I was very lucky to be part of a lot of public facing cases against people like Candy Crush and the Fine Brothers and et cetera, mm-hmm. where we were able to help the actual good guys in the situation for no money. And that no money, though, turned into good marketing, good opportunities. And before you knew it, I had a law firm. I found Allison, who I mentioned previously, the smartest attorney I've ever worked with, because I'm good at, I guess, talking on the internet. But she's definitely smarter than I am. I also recently, not recently, about a year ago, we partnered with a third partner, Keith Cooper, who's been practicing for nearly 30 years. He is the most awesome human on the planet. He does everything from corporate to intellectual property law, and he has matching tattoos with Axl Rose. So we have a kind of a super crew now, and we're able to tackle all areas of entertainment, but for sure, video games and esports are still our main bread and butter and main book.
Wow. That's... Hey, I didn't know that you brought on a third partner. That's very cool. At some point, when we're allowed to congregate, that isn't on a podcast. Yes, you'll
have
to come
have a drink.
Yeah, I definitely want to hear the Axl Rose story.
He literally started clubs with him like back in the day. He has the coolest story ever. Well, we're going to have to write like an expose on Keith and just, you know, all his deep, dark secrets from the past year.
That can't hurt now. We're in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah. No, it's great, though, having such different perspectives. I mean, I'm a huge loser, right? Like, I've been playing games my whole life, so I get this industry.
Yeah, Ryan, you're a huge loser. Thanks for being on the show.
No, I will I'm concede kidding, that like, you are a dork. Oh, I will concede sure. that.
I mean, no doubt. And I have
welcome to the party.
I got a Deadpool tattoo in 2004, and now it looks like I got a Ryan Reynolds tattoo when anybody sees it. So great.
Well, at least you know, it's Allison, Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool and not Ryan Reynolds as Green Lantern.
Yeah, I wish. But Allison comes from not video games, so she brings a very different perspective. And Keith's been in entertainment law for 30 years, so he brings a completely different perspective. So the three of us are really able to kind of work with any kind of client right now and walk them through this very, very difficult and complicated and ever-evolving space. You know, the fact that, I mean, it's the point of this podcast, right? I mean, you can pick any area from streaming to you know, anything, social media, that has changed so dramatically month to month, year to year, since this industry has kind of gained notoriety. Video games makes more money than music, movies, and TV combined right now. But the laws that control this industry were written for newspapers. So that's what we're dealing with.
So, you know, leading into, let's talk a little bit more about Evolution. So how did all of these different perspectives and all of your various experiences within the industry, how did that evolve into representing esports players?
Sure. So the thing I've always been very, very blown away by and honored by and lucky is that people were very happy to just publicly thank us when we were able to help them. And, you know, yeah, the video game attorney shtick became a thing because they would say, you wouldn't believe it. We found a video game attorney. He came in here and he fixed this, this, and this. He got my publisher to pay me. He fixed this terrible contract, whatever it was. And it started spreading throughout traditional news outlets, but also Reddit, Twitter, et cetera. And esports players started hitting me up saying, hey, we saw you helped these game developers. Can you help me? I haven't been paid in 6 months. Cyborg Matt, who is the he runs Team Secret right now, was the person who reached out originally. But that spiraled into dozens of Dota players, into dozens of League of Legends players, into now in 2015, I did 500 player contracts. And that number has only skyrocketed since. And we were doing all their legal work. However, most of these players didn't have an adult in their life to help them in any of this. So when we became closer, we showed that we were able to help them. They came and said, listen, it's great you can do the red lines, but can you also negotiate the deal? Can you find me sponsorships? Can you explain to me why I need a driver's license to fly on this airplane? Very quickly, it became more than a lawyer's relationship. And I started Evolve Talent Agency with separate partners. I'm the only one at both companies. Besides my assistant, who's awesome. But you know, the partners over there, there's three of them. It's Chris Lloyd, who's an ex-pro player, who's also an attorney. He's super sharp. It's Sebastian Delvaux, who is, you know, literally the smartest human I've ever talked to. He ran a YouTube MCN for a long time, which I knew nothing about. So he brought a very different skill set there. Sure. And then Barry Lee is the final one. He is also went to law school, has a great, great, great esports book. He's much more familiar with the League of Legends world than where I was coming from, Dota. And he speaks fluent Korean, so he's the only agent I'm aware of that represents Korean players over here, at least well. So we're a really solid. I'm very lucky that I found people better than me to build these companies with. And the esports players have that came to me originally because of the Reddit posts and the tweets have stayed with us because of them.
I love that. Yeah, that's so wholesome.
That is great. And real quickly, I just wanted to find something real quick. You mentioned an MCN. That is a multi-channel network, correct?
Right. All yes, right. It is they're most commonly referred to as the evil companies behind YouTube channels, but they're not evil. Just evil people run some of the bigger ones. Sebastian runs Paragon, which does a ton of work with, various creators. And obviously he takes good care of them or I would not be working with him.
Sure. True. Absolutely. And, you know, there have been, I mean, MCNs, that's a completely different topic for a different day, but I wanted to make sure you mentioned it, that we defined it, because that's
mini term sheet.
A mini term sheet. Yeah, we have a segment that we did earlier. It's called Term Sheet, where we explain like business term. Because
I dig that.
Because I am terrible with puns.
Yeah, you are.
Yep. All right. So one of the things that we have visited over and over and over again on the show, because hey, it's our life right now. Obviously, the COVID crisis has had a significant impact on the industry. We're seeing lots of changes touching every different aspect. Esports has not gone untouched. We've had big event cancellations. There's been a transition to online play for those leagues that are still doing their thing.
Yeah.
We're curious, from your perspective, is this crisis likely to have a long-lasting impact on esports? And if so, what do you think those impacts are going to
be? Yes. I think this crisis has shined a light on all of the terrible, terrible ventures within esports that VCs, venture capitalists, have been funding, because eventually it'll work. I think this pandemic has turned so much money, eyeballs, and attention to esports that the things that do work are working amazingly. And the things that don't work are failing miserably. And the VCs who are, the stock market's crumbling and everything else, they're pulling their money out. So we're going to see a drastic change where, with a lot of the biggest teams, are going to go out of business. Mm-hmm. Other teams, though, that have been, smart about their business model and what they can do, are going to thrive. And I think you're going to tell very quickly who's who over the next few months. Obviously, we're pretty deep into knowing who is who and understanding where the contracts stand with a lot of our guys. But everybody will know soon. Also, outside of just teams versus talent, you're going to see leagues fail. You're going to see media things fail. There were some teams, there's some events and leagues that rely solely on those live events, and they're not happening. Other things have proven that they can survive virtually, and not only survive, but like I said, thrive. And I think we're seeing a lot of that.
Well, I think this is a good opportunity. We like to shine a spotlight on the things that are positive, that are working well. In your opinion, what are some of the standouts that have made the most of this situation?
I mean, Twitch has been incredible. Everyone that works at Twitch you cannot imagine the extra hours and overtime they're doing. They went down for maintenance the other day, and it really just kind of spoke to me that I can't recall a time prior to that where they did that. They are so on top of their stuff with the engineering team there. It's incredible the bandwidth that they make happen. But also, beyond that, there's the individual talent on those streams. We represent XQC, for example, and Chica and people like that are just blowing up right now, but capitalizing on it and doing it the right way, where they are going to retain an audience and grow and build something, not just take a quick check to go to a competing platform and then disappear. So that, there are short term cash out plays and there's long term build a brand plays. And it's really interesting to watch everybody make those decisions and see who's doing it the right way. Also, brands and people coming into this space, it's just great for esports as a whole that so many brands are finally saying, okay, this is real. Look at all the eyeballs here. Mm-hmm. Sports is canceled. Well, look at what's going on with NASCAR. Look at what's going on with the NBA, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Let's go over here and look at League of Legends. Let's look at Fortnite. Let's look at Apex, et cetera. And they're realizing very quickly, and yes, I'm biased as I own a talent agency, but they're learning very quickly that they get way more bang for their buck to work with a player and talent directly than go sponsor a whole team for a little spot on a jersey logo.
No, that makes good sense.
Absolutely.
That leads us into our next point. Is we've heard a lot, especially over the last, 18 months, about the esports bubble. And we talked, you touched a little bit on that just now, but we want to know, like, what what is going on there? You're saying that VCs are pulling their money because the stock market is crumbling and everything like that. So who is making money right now? Can we talk about that? Like, who's doing it right?
Yeah, so that's it's interesting, right? Because every team realized about 6 months ago, it seems, that their monetization scheme is bad. There are exceptions. Liquid, for example, mm-hmm. is, you know, killing it. And Liquid and Steve and Victor, who run Liquid, are geniuses. They really are. They've figured out how to
be they're profitable brilliant. Every time.
Yeah, and listen, it's fun to insult them or be a rabid fan, but it's insane to not give credit to FaZe and 100 Thieves and these orgs that have come out as more than orgs. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
They're not just teams. They're brands. They're lifestyles. And then, of course, you know, there's the other tier one teams that everybody is aware of. However, you're seeing a lot of other brands that are, you know, for example, we just brought we have in most of our contracts now. It was a huge win for us. We really fought hard to get players the ability to get independent sponsorships. They never used to. They all had to be team deals. So what we got was in their contracts, the ability to get sponsorships. This is years ago. This is standard now. Mm-hmm. They can get sponsorships as long as it's not conflicting with the team sponsors. However, now we have one or two teams in particular who we brought sponsors to and said, hey, you know, here's what's in the contract. Here's the normal procedure. We have a deal for X player. And they said, no, we kind of realized that we're not making enough money. And especially with everything going on, tell the brand we're only interested in working. We're only interested in team-wide deals, and the player doesn't get it, and you don't get it, and give me your contact at that brand. So these teams are now it's insane. The team's demanding I give them my contacts that we shopped a deal for, take the deal. So not only would my company lose the commission, but more importantly, the player loses the deal. It's no longer their activation. It's the team's activation, and no brand wants to do that. So as brands are coming into this space and finally willing to spend money and understand it, et cetera, they're going to get ripped off the same way that that brands were 5 years ago. And it's really a shame. And on the flip side, again, going back to Liquid or Energy or some of these other companies that work great with brands and do team-wide activations, there is still room for the independent activations. Mm-hmm. There are situations where brands should work with the team. There's also situations where they should work directly with the player.
And I think that makes a lot of sense. And we talk about different approaches in literally every other facet of this industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like the cookie cutter model of sponsoring a whole team isn't necessarily the right fit. Are there some like rule of thumb examples where you see like there are better fits in certain types of sponsorships for players versus teams?
Yeah, it's interesting because it depends on what you're selling. It also depends on the team. You know, a FaZe sponsorship is very different than a Liquid sponsorship is very different than a, you know, whoever sponsorship. So that's kind of, you know, where the consultants make their money here is figuring out how to come in organically but still be compliant with FTC rules.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is so many, just like there's bad owners out there, there's also bad consultants out there. I mean, if you go on LinkedIn, how many people have esports consultant in their bio, but they've never worked anywhere, they don't understand the space, they have no insider knowledge, and it's just insane that brands pick those people, but they do. You see some of the most evil humans in the world keep getting consulting jobs in this space just because they can say they've already done consulting jobs in this space. And it's a shame, but hopefully we're evolving past those people.
So you also mentioned like there are some things that we're finding that aren't working, right? And I know that naming names is not really what we're going for.
So let's talk about tactics instead.
Yeah,
let's talk about strategies that you're starting to see, you know, either fray around the edges or collapse entirely.
Sure. For the actual sponsorship, you're saying?
Or just in general, like aspects of the esports segment where you talked about things that are working really well, things that aren't working.
Yeah,
really.
So I'm a huge. So it used to be everyone would get so up in arms if you said, you know, esports and traditional sports have a lot of parallels. They have a lot of overlap. That is so true. But people used to get really upset about it. Now they seem to not only be not upset about it, but they seem to think they're the same thing, and they're not.
No.
It really drives me nuts seeing, you know, League of Legends thrown on ABC or thrown on ESPN. It's not for that audience. And it takes a lot to get somebody to see something for the first time and understand it and watch it and be part of it. And I think that, you know, whenever anybody gets so excited, oh my God, you won't believe, you know, esports was on ESPN yesterday. To me, it just doesn't matter unless it's done a certain way. you know, my friends send me texts making fun of me saying, ha, your nerd stuff's on ESPN. They're not watching it. They're not giving it a chance. It's not the right way to progress. And also, I don't know where the audience is for things like Madden or NBA 2K. Sports fans don't want to watch video games necessarily, and video game fans don't want to watch sports games necessarily. Obviously, FIFA has proven to be an exception, and that means maybe Madden and NBA can also, but I haven't seen a strategy or game plan to make them exceptions.
Do you think that we're seeing some acceptance that we wouldn't because of the crisis? Like, I know that there's been sports programming with Madden, for instance, or with The Show, you know, in place of live sports. Do you think that is an on-ramp for people who might have not shown an interest in watching video games? Or is that is that going to reach its terminus at, okay, well, I'm only interested in watching this because there's no live sports.
This and is I just still, my stopgap.
Yeah, and I won't actually go and watch other video games that aren't sports video games.
I 100% believe for the most part it's a stopgap, and I believe they don't care about esports. I think what Madden did, which is interesting, is they're just simulating games. You're not watching two pros play each other. You're watching the computer play itself, which is kind of fun and interesting in a weird way. Like, there's no sports on at the bar? Here, we'll simulate a Madden game everybody can watch. People just like rooting for things. It's fun. I would enjoy that, and I love the NFL. So I think that's super interesting. I also think that the more traditional esports side of thing is going to get some fans out of this for sure. I mean, I can't tell you how many people have reached out about it. But once the NFL is back, they're not watching simulated games anymore.
No, definitely not. Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense. Now, again, going back to this concept of the esports bubble, one of the things that we've talked about and we've read a little bit about is this concept that people are pretending to make money in esports. And it's that VC thing, right? We're gonna keep throwing money at it because we think it'll
and
eventually
maybe it'll
work.
Find some way to monetize itself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So what are some of those things that you think are just going to disappear after this crisis because people realize, like, hey, it wasn't working before, certainly not working now, and should we even bother trying to bring it back after?
You know, there's some startups that I think might have worked that are going to fail, and then some businesses that are going to survive because they'll get another round of funding just because of who they are. It's so hard to say. It really is. I think the competitors to Twitch are not doing very well. There's also a million levers they can pull to fix that. Mm-hmm. But there's so many. That part is you know, kind of, I know we're here for a bigger conversation, but that's almost a bigger conversation than I can even just kind of throw out.
That's fair.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I will not be shy on Twitter to shame the bad guys as they fall.
Okay. That is true.
So definitely stay tuned for that.
Stay tuned for all of the dunks.
Yes. I guess the partner to that last question is this. When it comes to selling sponsorships for events, and I think this is a big piece of the monetization. We talked about how live events are a big piece of some of the business models for some of the players. Are we going to see a revision or some changes to the way those companies are forced to seek sponsorships? Are these companies being honest about the metrics that they're using when they're selling sponsorships? Are they?
No.
Boy, I didn't think it was going to be that easy. All right. Do go on.
I've yet to see an investor deck from an esports org that wasn't riddled with nonsense. And it's all, even the accounting system. So, I mean, I'm not an accountant. I don't do finance. I can barely do basic addition. But when
what
you
are
report,
numbers even?
Exactly. But when you report top line income to an investor, what you're supposed to be reporting is, all right, here's what we made before our expenses, our cost of operations, etc. If a team sells a sponsorship for 10 grand, let's say, and they're giving 9 grand of that to a player and they're only keeping 10% of it, they report all 100% as income to the team because it passes through the team. They collect it and they pay it out.
Yeah, it's all top
that
line.
Is straight up fraud. And it's so insane to do that because I know on their taxes they're reporting the exact opposite. So it's very strange to see all of the accounting going on. But then the same thing
the
is going on.
Creative accounting.
And then the same thing's going on when you see viewable minutes. How many eyeballs do you have on your roster? Well, 72 billion. because we have a player in the Overwatch League, and then he, you know, the Overwatch League has this many numbers, and the Overwatch League is run by Blizzard, which has these games, and World of Warcraft has 14 million subscribers. So technically, those are all eyeballs on my one player. And it's just so much, you know, mental leaping here that makes no sense if you know the industry, but these investors don't. They just know the word esports and that they want to be in it.
So given what this is kind of, I'm going to kick the door wide open on this. Given what we know of with Facebook and the pivot to video and the inflated metrics.
Oh, I see where you're going.
Is there another shoe that's going to drop on esports orgs if they survive? That where investors who are desperate for anything good coming out of this or any kind of salvation from investments that may have been good but turned bad because of the crisis or bad investments that turned worse, is there going to be a legal shoe that drops for fraudulent metrics?
The only reason there hasn't been yet is because the people who are in charge of those administrations or groups that would go after them can barely work their emails, so they don't understand video games. You know, half of the political party in this country thinks angels are real and hate gay people. So we're a few steps behind getting them to, police the video game industry properly. Mm-hmm. But man, oh man, will there be regulations and lawsuits coming down and a lot more over the next few years. I'm shocked it hasn't happened yet, to be frank, but it'll come.
Well, reign of terror in our future, but in the best
way.
But
it's only people who deserve it. Yeah, exactly. There's so many people doing things the right way, for real.
Oh, definitely.
And I try not to focus on just the bad guys, but, you know, the truly evil ones are gone. They're out of the industry. There's plenty, though, of less scrupulous people left, and they're going to get theirs, too.
And I think, you know, I think that's a good place for us to wrap with just the moral of the story being, you know, you might think it's a good idea to overinflate your metrics, but man, it's going to bite you in the butt down the road.
That's right.
Don't be evil.
Don't be evil.
Don't be evil.
Don't be evil.
We have an indie spotlight today. Today on the show, we are welcoming Trevor Oz from Winterborn, which has just announced its first game. Trevor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast today.
Trevor, Winterborn just announced his first game. Please tell us a little bit about what you're working on.
Our team is currently hard at work on our first game. It's called Externus, Path of the Solari. And it is a tactical role-playing game that's story-driven, that follows a group of characters and their struggles during their adventures. And it's a story that we wanted to tell for a long time, actually. It's based on a homebrew tabletop game that our studio head, Kent, had created when he was a teenager and that we played from our teenage years into our early college years. And it's something that we wanted to share for so long, and we've always told stories about our adventures during that time to other people, and it's awesome to be able to take that and the world that we created together and actually put it into a video game, and we're all very excited about it.
You know, one of the things we talk about on the show, and we've talked about with a number of indie developers, is the current quarantine and the crisis. Curious, how has the current situation impacted development of Externus?
So the quarantine itself has been a little bit of a double-edged sword for us as we were gearing up to release our first teaser trailer, and we're working on finalizing our pre-alpha demo. So right now our artist, Moody, his job is actually paying him to not work while they're closed down for right now. So he has a normal day job. A few of us on the team do actually work normal day jobs. So as far as Moody's concerned, he was able to get more art done because of the quarantine than at least in a quicker amount of time. And we were able to get some stuff done to actually be able to show the game off, at least during the time period that we wanted to. Our goal was to have the teaser trailer out by middle of April, and we were able to accomplish that goal. So in that aspect, it helped. I think where the quarantine is actually hurting is that I know for me personally, it has definitely affected my productivity. I don't feel like I've been as productive as I normally would, at least during the early days of the quarantine. And that was only because I think a lot of my anxiety was getting to me about the situation. And I think that hurt my personal productivity. But I think other than that, I don't think it's had too much of an effect on us as a studio. Like I said, we've been working remotely, so I think that actually helped us out a little bit in that aspect, because we were already kind of prepared for that sort of situation.
So Winterborn has just released its first trailer for Externus. You've been working under quarantine, you've been getting things done, but as we've talked about before on the show and as I've talked with individual developers about, there are a number of things that the quarantine makes more challenging, and that there are resources that might not be available or might be harder to find given the situation. What are the things that you need right now in order to move the project forward?
So we're still pretty early in development on Externus, but we've been working hard for about a year and probably about a year and a half. November of 2018 is when we had our initial meeting with everybody at the studio in person for about a month, where we went through everything and basically planned out the whole game, did our planning meetings, and then we actually started active development in January of 2019, and that's what we've been doing ever since. A lot of it has been working on the engine, because our studio head, Kent, he wanted to make his own engine. It's based off the Mono Game architecture, but he wanted to do his own engine because that's something that he hadn't been able to do while working for AAA development. So he wanted to learn a new skill and add that to his skill. So for us, I think what we need for the next phase is we need to figure out a way to pay for another artist. Because we have one artist right now. He's an awesome artist, Moody. He's absolutely fantastic, as you can see from some of the art from our teaser. I love what he does, and he has a great eye for art. But there is so much art in this game that we need some additional art support. So hopefully we're looking at different ways that we want to try to get some additional funding so that we can get another artist. So we're weighing those options now, and hopefully we'll have something to announce or talk about in May. That's when we plan to have our pre-alpha demo and our full reveal trailer out sometime during May. So I think that's what we're gearing up towards now. So hopefully we'll know more when that situation comes. But yeah, we need more funding. We've been self-funded for now up until this point. So yeah, we just need to be able to hire somebody on to give Moody the support he needs so that we can basically put out as more art assets and make sure we can actually finish with our goal in mind.
Trevor, thank you so much for joining us today and talking to us a little bit about Externus. Before we let you go, where can people find you and Winterborn on social media?
So yeah, you can follow us on social media at Winterborn Games on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I reply to as much as possible on any of those platforms, pretty much anywhere. I will try to reply as best as I can. You can follow me personally at Trevor Oz, TrevorOsz. And just for basic game updates and everything, go to externusgame.com or winterborngames.com, and we will have our updates pretty frequently on those sites. We even do our own podcast called How to Build a Game Studio that is basically us talking about how we built our game studio and how we're working on our first game, Externus. And we've also had some other game devs and stuff on before, so check that out.
Excellent. Trevor, thank you so much. And we're looking forward to checking out Externus when you guys are ready to share more with us.
Thank you.
All right. And if you are an indie that wants to share their work on the show, our DMs are open. You can send us a DM at virtualeconcast or shoot us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz.
And this has been episode 14.
Episode 14.
Holy moly. Boom. We've done 14 episodes. Thank you for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @virtualeconcast. I'm at Amanda Farrow.
And I am at Footerish, F-U-T-T-E-R-I-S-H. Ryan, where can people find you?
I'm at Morrison, M-O-R-R-I-S-O-N.
That's great.
That's really simple.
Awesome.
It's way more simple than us.
And if you're tuning in for the first time because you heard that Ryan was going to be on the show and you wanted to hear him say
his dulcet tones.
His, yes. The sweet sounds of Ryan Morrison. You can subscribe.
Single drops. The single show. Drops next month.
Oh, yeah?
That's right. Sweet sounds of Ryan Morrison.
And you guys will have to come on my podcast, Robot Congress.
I would absolutely love that. That sounds awesome.
Dip, yeah, cross-branding.
Woo!
Hell yeah.
So if you are not currently subscribed to the show, you can do so at virtualeconomy.libsyn. That's LIBSYN.com/RSS. You can also listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. Please subscribe. That tells the algorithm gods that we're important and you should listen to us. And if possible, review the show. We'd love to know what you think because we care.
We do care. And if you want to DM us with questions or if you have things that you want to tell us, you can DM us at @virtualeconcast. You can also send them to podcast@fsquared.biz. And we will be back soon. Probably next week.
Definitely next week.
Okay, definitely next week. It's true. We do have something booked, and it's really cool. Yeah. So you should definitely follow us on Twitter. In the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another. And we'll see you next time.